Go behind the wheel and under the hood on everything automotive with high-speed stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin, an auto editor, or the auto editor, here at HowStuffWorks.com, and I'm joined by...
Ben Bolin. I'm a video writer here at HowStuffWorks. And Scott, I think you're being a little too modest when you forget to add the there.
Well, I'm the only one right now.
Yeah, you're kind of like a... Yeah. I'm Maverick. Do I say that too often?
Probably.
Hey, I was thinking of this other one. Scott the Barbarian Benjamin.
Oh.
I know, but you're so nice to people.
The Barbarian.
I need you to do more barbaric things.
Why don't you just... How about Ben the Terrible Bolin?
So you've been talking to my mother.
No. We'll throw around some more.
We'll throw around some more.
Yeah, the Barbarian, I don't think I'm...
I don't know.
Ben, you've probably seen... I am powerfully built, but... Not to that extreme. Not a barbarian.
Well, you know you're sophisticated, I imagine, as well. So it evens out.
I hope everybody knows I'm kidding. I couldn't.
We've got listener mail. Actually, I'll go into that. But I've got to tell you. I know I came in a little bit of a rush. I seemed kind of crazy and sort of demanded that everything stop until I get some coffee. Mm-hmm. And that's because I had a very strange schedule today. I was in a hurry. And Scott, I was in a hurry in traffic, which is one of the worst places to be in a hurry.
Correct.
And I thought, man, if I just had a helicopter or a plane of some sort, I realized that wouldn't be fast enough.
Flying car.
Touché, my friend. Yeah. Flying car, if I'm in that much of a rush, I probably would not drive safely.
And don't open up that can of worms, by the way.
We're going to leave
have you done?
Those worms in the can.
Yeah, that's okay.
But what will we do? That's what we should talk about today. What is faster than a plane, faster than a car? What could I do if I'm in a hurry?
I guess you could go supersonically.
Supersonically?
Yeah, you could go supersonically.
Is that some sort of band reference?
I don't know. I guess you could go supersonic. They do supersonic car testing out in the deserts.
Sure. Okay. We've talked about that.
Yeah, sure. But there was a supersonic plane you could have taken as well. No longer in, I guess, rotation. It's retired.
What
I'm talking about, right?
You're talking about the Concorde.
The Concorde, yeah. This awesome plane, Concorde. And actually, we got a couple of listeners that wanted to hear about the Concorde, so I think this is a perfect opportunity to do that.
Yeah, let's hear from them.
All right, so let's get into these letters here. We got one from longtime listener Constantine, and that comes from early November.
Okay.
And Constantine just simply says, please do an episode on the Concorde.
Short and sweet, yeah.
Short and sweet. And we've got another one that came in later in the year. And this one is from Clayton from St. Charles, Illinois. And Clayton, who wrote in at the end of December last year, said that, I really love the podcast. Wondering if you guys could do a show about the Concorde airplane. I know it's fast and really cool to look at, but that's about it. So hopefully, we can go into a little bit more detail about it. So let's just give this kind of a general approach here and see where we go. And I'm sure it'll head a lot of different directions, but
should be fun. To quote Lewis Carroll, let's start at the beginning.
Okay.
Kind of see our way through the middle and stop once we hit the end.
Good plan.
So maybe just for a quick overview, if we could encapsulate this, what's the difference between your garden variety airplane and a Concorde?
I've already given it away. Supersonic flight. Supersonic flight. This thing flew at Mach 2. Which was, what is Mach 2? That's something like 1,400 miles per hour, I think is what it is. It's 13,
over 1,000.
It's like 1,350 miles per hour is what the cruising speed of this thing was. So it was able to make flights in incredible, just short amounts of time over the Atlantic. It was a transatlantic flight meant to reduce the time between, let's say, New York and London and, of course, back as well, and New York and Paris and back. And it did make several other flights, like maybe down to Barbados and a few other charter flights. But those were the main routes, were New York to London, New York to Paris, and then, of course, the flight back as well.
Yeah, and let's be absolutely clear. This is a commercial flight route that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So this wasn't like your normal jets where they're a co-pilot or something. They had a cargo full of passengers.
Yeah, that's right. They had up to 100 passengers. They had 9 crew members for those 100 passengers, including the pilots. It was just a remarkable plane. I mean, it was able to make the crossing, and I believe, I'll look this up in just a moment because we'll get to it, but I believe it's just over 3 hours It would be able to make the flight across the Atlantic. Wow. So you're talking about an extremely fast plane, a very efficient way to get there. But I think it was really a status symbol. It was really all about the service and just the exclusivity of saying that you're able to fly in the Concorde. I don't know how many times the speed came into it. Of course, that's a nice side benefit that it's extremely fast. But it did have this this mystique about it, this presence that, you know, I've flown on the Concorde. It was a very prestigious thing to be able to say. Mm-hmm. You were you could receive a certificate that was signed by the captain and several other people. I don't remember who else was on that certificate as well. But it was very expensive. And, again, very fast and very exclusive. Even though they made several flights, several thousand flights in the lifetime of the plane, it still remained an exclusive flight because it was just out of reach of normal, mm-hmm. I want to say normal, but average people with average income.
If you travel coach, not because you're trying to save money, but because that's what you can afford, odds are you could not afford to ride on the Concorde.
No, in fact, you know what? I found some information about the price of the tickets.
Oh, man. All right, this is going to hit me. Go ahead.
Are you, okay.
I'm ready.
And this is information that was just kind of gathered in on fan sites here and there.
You know what, Scott, before we do it?
Yeah.
Let's do the time, the career of the plane.
Oh, the plane. Oh, sure. Yeah. I believe that it was the first flight was in around 1969.
Okay.
Early 1969. Those were kind of test flights. Those were just getting the thing, you know, getting the legs, I guess. Mm-hmm. It was right around 76.
Okay.
That it went into a routine flight pattern between New York and London, New York and Paris. I believe it's 1976. It might have been as early as 1974. Again, it's buried in my notes here.
So in the heyday of the 70s.
Yeah, in the heyday of the 70s, and it was retired, get this, not until 2003. So this thing flew until 2003, late 2003. I for some reason, had pictured this thing being retired early in the mid-90s.
I thought it was around a little bit before the Atlanta Olympics or something.
Yeah, no, it was 2003 was when this thing was finally retired.
Huh.
So, again, a lot longer of a lifespan than I thought that it had, but
okay. So when we do the price of a ticket, then we don't really have to make a large calculation for inflation or something. This isn't like 1902 dollars.
No. This is 1980s and 1990s dollars, though. So there is some adjustment that would need to be made because we're talking about close to 30 years now.
All right, I'm ready.
Well, 30 years. You ready?
Yes.
Now, again, this is just gathered via fan sites, but I was seeing prices that ranged anywhere between $8,000 and $11,000.
Oh, $1,000. I was nodding my head at first.
You thought I was going to say $1,100,
didn't you? Yeah, I was thinking, okay, because it's a nice
no,
jet.
Between
$11,000?
Between $8,000 and $11,000 was just kind of that was a kind of an average that I found, I'd say.
Do you get to take a piece of the jet home with you for $11,000?
No, but you did get exceptional service while you were on the plane.
Yeah, they better sign a certificate.
It was, it was first class all the way. It was five-star. Beautiful. I mean, unbelievable meals were served to you. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many courses the meals were, but
sure. But obviously, gourmet quality.
Of course, yeah.
You have your own. You have a private area of some sort. I imagine you're in a first class equivalent.
Equivalent, yeah, because it had four. It was a very narrow fuselage, so it had two seats on either side. Very wide, comfortable seats. Mm-hmm. It only sat 100 people, and this is a big airplane. But it was very small. It was a small. I guess if you want to say it this way, the tube where mm-hmm. the people sat are
the
passenger area is very, very small compared to what you would expect on a big airliner that's going to make a trip this fast. Mm-hmm. It's just an interesting thing to note that between $8,000 and $11,000 in the 80s and 90s, I would I've seen people say that for the last flight I would pay as high as this, and
really?
Some of these numbers. Now, maybe it's just talking, but they
sure.
said for the last flight of the Concorde, they would have paid as much as $25,000-$30,000 for that flight. Just be in that group of people to say you were the last people to fly in the Concorde.
Huh.
So people were willing to pay for this, and these are people that had flown on it previously.
Oh, okay.
Who said I would pay $25,000 for the experience again to say that I was the last. person on the
phone. That changes it a little.
Yeah, yeah. They said it is worth every penny of the money that they spent for it. I didn't find any bad experiences.
Sure.
Of course, there was a very bad experience that happened in 2000. But what I'm saying is that the people that you know flew it successfully really enjoyed the flight, and they would do it again.
Did you catch that, guys?
Yeah.
Listening to the podcast, that was a little bit of foreshadowing.
Yeah.
But we're not going to go there yet.
Okay.
Do you want to? I think maybe we should talk about some of the
Positives.
Yes.
yeah, because there's one negative that comes up here, but that's not the downfall of the plane, by the way. Not the downfall of the service.
Oh.
Yeah.
So time for me to shuffle my notes.
So it had some really unique features to it. Of course, it's a extremely powerful jet. It flies at Mach 2. Mm. So there's a lot of it flies at 60,000 feet, Ben. This thing is capable of cruising at 60,000 feet, so it's above anything else.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to worry about other vehicles in its flight path, only unless it's another SST, another Concorde SST on a similar pattern. So 60,000 feet, that's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the average flight, the average service between New York and London at the time, just a regular subsonic service, was right around 7 or 8 hours. That's London to New York or New York to London. Again, this one was able to make it in, I just found my notes here, 3 hours and 30 minutes was about the average time. There was a record run that was made in 1996. And in 1996, the fastest ever time for crossing the Atlantic, which set by a passenger aircraft, was 2 hours and 52 minutes and 59 seconds. So you're talking a little less than 2 hours and 52, well, 1 second less than 2 hours and 52 minutes, 53 minutes, whatever.
There are movies that are longer than that.
Yeah, that's right.
I think is the point.
Yeah, exactly. You couldn't even watch an in-flight movie if it was a long movie.
If it was the director's cut of something.
Exactly. So this is a remarkable plane. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Oh, and just for comparison, right, a Boeing 747, in terms of elevation, we're talking about 35,000 feet. So for people who are wondering, 60,000 feet, what does that mean? That means you're almost twice as high in the air.
You're 11 miles in the air, 11 miles above the surface of the Earth. So, I don't know, it's pretty amazing. I believe you can see the curvature of the Earth at a certain point. And I know that I've read things, and I don't have that in my notes here, but I have read accounts of people flying that said they were able to see the sunset twice. Because they were able to, you catch up to the sun on your travel if you're traveling in the right direction. Pretty remarkable.
Yeah, especially if they're serving booze on the flight.
So the sun would set, you'd take off, you'd head out, the sun would rise again, and then you would land and the sun would set again.
Oh, that's trippy.
In the same day.
That's,
yeah.
Is it even the same day? We're verging on philosophy there.
I don't know. I guess it depends on what flight, or what international lines you'd pass. And
right,
things like
yeah,
that,
but, if you pass the dateline.
Yeah.
And the body is noticeably different, too. If you saw this on the airport runway.
Yeah, we mentioned that it was super narrow.
Yes.
It has a very unique kind of a wedge shape to it.
Mm-hmm.
But one other thing is that crazy nose.
A crazy nose. Okay. Now, I think I know what you're going to say that makes the nose different from, average airplane or non-jet airplane, rather. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why it's this way.
Okay. The reason is they need a extremely pointed cone-shaped nose on this thing to be able to cut through the air the way that it does. It can't have kind of the snub nose like we see on a lot of commercial jets. It's very, very rounded. This one has to come down right to a very fine point at the front. And for the length that it needed to be for it to be, I guess, stable at speed, it had to be exceptionally long, and the pilot and co-pilot couldn't see over the nose when they were landing and taking off. So it gave them kind of this weird perception of where they were and how to, it's a visual thing as well as mechanical when you're landing and taking off. And they designed the nose of this thing to droop down. So I'm trying to think of which one it was. I believe it's when they were taking off, the nose could drop 5 degrees. And when they were landing, the nose could drop 12 and a half degrees for landing so they could see the runway in front of them. But,
so it was movable.
Yeah, it was movable. And it was actually capable of 17 and a half degrees, but they found out that the nose was going down too low. And there was just a chance that it was totally out of view, and it gave them just kind of a weird visual reference point that just wasn't quite right. You know, it was tough to figure out where that nose was. That it's so far down.
Now, have you ever seen a Concorde in real life?
I have not.
I saw one when I was younger at, I guess it had to be New York airport. But my uncle told me, because I remember, I'm pretty sure it was my uncle's, either him or my father, told me that these noses moved because the pilots got in that way somehow, that, you know, when the no. that maybe the nose moved and it revealed some sort of entrance.
A stairway.
And for years, I thought that was the case. No. So anybody who has talked with a member of my family or someone else who thinks that's funny, you guys, they're lying to you.
I think it's funny.
Yeah, well, it didn't happen to you. I'm glad my childhood trauma amuses you so, Mr. Benjamin.
Yeah, it does. It okay. does. Sometimes it does. But, yeah. Oh, never mind.
Okay, well, another thing that's different. And moving on, this yeah, is something sure. They didn't lie to me about. The Concorde's wing design are also pretty noticeably different.
Yeah, they are, because the air intakes and inlets are different. They have this crazy set of louvers that adjust and inlets and exhausts and at different speeds. Well, how much do you know about this? Because I know very little. I'm just going to give you a cursory.
I know a little bit.
Well, hit me with it, because okay. mine is so top level or high level that it doesn't really do much.
I'll go down in the dirt.
Good.
Okay, a delta wing design. That's what this is called. And it reduces drag. They have it this way mainly because, just like the nose, it's designed to reduce drag. Because with the way that a jet works and the speeds at which this vehicle is moving, could be drastically reduced by any sort of, you know, by a snub-nosed plane or yeah. by the conventional wing design of a, again, conventional plane. So this delta wing design also provides more lift for takeoff and landing, again, at these high speeds, because when they're taking off, they're reaching those high speeds faster than a conventional airplane would.
Okay, understood. Because I've heard that the takeoff speed was way higher than
yes,
even though you're still talking about an airplane that's just like any other airplane. It's taking off on the same runway. It doesn't have to take off in a shorter distance or anything like that. Its takeoff speed was something like 250 miles per hour, which is way above anything else that takes off these days. Yeah. You know, they achieve that speed and more, of course, in the air. But takeoff speed 250 is, that's pretty high.
That is.
Hope I didn't steal any thunder there, but
no.
And you know, the other thing is, I noticed that the tip of the aircraft gets extremely hot. We were just talking about the nose of this thing.
Yeah.
It gets extremely hot in flight, and it says that it can reach up to 260 degrees Fahrenheit. Just due to the friction at that high speed. So when it's traveling at 1,350 or 1,400 miles per hour, again, Mach 2, the tip of this airplane can be up to as much as 260 degrees. So extremely hot.
I didn't think about that, but it makes sense when you think about
it. Yeah, it does. I mean, just air friction. And, of course, everything about this plane is meant to be streamlined and smooth. I mean, you're talking about a needle-nose point on this thing. So imagine if it was blunt. I don't know if it would even be able to achieve that speed, but can you imagine the friction and the heat that would be caused by something that was a little bit more blunt than that?
So maybe here we segue into some of the less positive stuff.
There was a single crash in its history. And now there were over 20 of these built. Mm-hmm. And I believe, I'm straining my memory, I think 14 of them went into service and the other six were distributed somewhere else. They were prototypes, things like that. One of these airliners crashed on July 25th in the year 2000. It was in France, and it killed everybody on board. 100 passengers, 9 crew members, and 4 people on the ground, because it crashed into a hotel. A lot of people remember this flight. It's flight 4590. There's some amateur video of it that someone shot. It looked like they were traveling in a car when they saw it kind of go across the roadway. I don't know if you've seen this or not, but you can see the plane clearly struggling. It's got a ball of flame coming out from underneath it. It travels all the way across, leaving this big black trail of smoke. And then the next thing you see in the video is just this huge plume of black smoke, but it's way off in the distance, and you can see where it's hit the hotel.
It's terrible.
Yeah, it is terrible. What happened was, and this is, again, I think this is from ConcordeSST.com.
Okay.
I believe that came from this. Anyways, I got a bunch of information from a bunch of different places, but what they concluded was the cause of this accident was that there was a titanium strip that was part of another airplane that had taken off just minutes before the Concorde that had fallen off. It was part of a thrust reverser from a DC-10 that was on the airstrip. And the Concorde, when it was taken off, it ran over that strip. The tire was immediately punctured, so it exploded.
Mm-hmm.
Then a piece of rubber flew up and hit the fuel tank. The fuel tank had what they called a hydrodynamic shock wave, which means that the fuel shifted and actually broke the fuel tank open. The rubber, in the meantime, has hit an electrical line, which caused sparks. So now the fuel tank is ruptured. There's sparks from this broken broken electrical line.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, sparks and fuel don't mix, and flames started. Now, once that started, there's a fire alert, so the crew knew about it immediately. They probably felt the tire explode as well. And they tried to shut down the engine. They couldn't get the landing gear retracted in time, so they're just losing altitude. They can't get enough speed up, and that's when they crashed.
Huh.
Terrible.
It is terrible.
Terrible.
And here's the question. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay, well, here's the question that immediately becomes apparent, and we've talked about this before, Scott. One of the biggest differences, between a plane that goes this fast and, a 747 or a DC-10 is the ability to, or I'm sorry, the latitude you have in making decisions in crisis situations. Because if something went wrong with that jet, and it's losing altitude, but it's still going faster than a DC-10.
It's already past the point of no return on its takeoff. It can't shut down. They had already lifted off. They were already going 250 miles per hour. They're doing everything they can. They tried to shut the engine down. They tried to retract the gear. They tried to get it to climb. They were just going to circle right around and come right back. Mm-hmm. The thing is, they couldn't get that accomplished. It wasn't possible. So, I hate to say what was and what wasn't possible. I'm no aeronautics engineer or anything, but I'm just going by the reports that I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't possible for them to recover from that, so that's what happened.
Excellent comparison.
Yeah.
If you get a flat tire in a car going 40 miles an hour,
yeah,
it's a lot easier to pull over safely than if you get a flat tire in a car going 500 miles an hour.
Exactly. Yeah. And this, unfortunately, the tire was just the beginning of it. Mm-hmm. You heard all the steps that happened here in order and what happened, just the progression of this accident. And that's the way it is with a lot of these accidents. There's one minor thing that happens, and then that just snowballs into this catastrophe.
Mm-hmm. And so, one thing after the other.
Yeah, exactly. But now, surprising enough, that wasn't what halted the flight to the Concorde. What happened was it was just a big mix of things. They list other factors as one of the things. So that could be anything, really. But,
sure, that could be internal disagreements.
Exactly.
Or something.
But there was also some major plane renovations, I guess, or major plane upgrades that were coming their way. Based on the crash information, they had to fix, what was wrong with the tires there. Mm-hmm. They had to fix, the possibility of that happening again. So they did that. Then there was the economic effects from September 11, 2001. And I guess, that was kind of on the horizon for them as well. And I don't know if they actually did it or didn't do it, but it was going to cost, it was tens of millions of dollars of upgrades for these planes. And it just wasn't something that was economically feasible, and the company went under. Branson offered to purchase the airliners. He wanted to buy a couple of these.
We're talking Richard Branson.
Yeah, exactly. Richard Branson. And was it Virgin Airlines? Is that right?
Yeah, Virgin Airlines, yeah. Also Virgin Mobile, I believe.
He offered to buy these things, and he was denied for whatever price he was asking. I don't remember. But anyways, it worked its way out that, the company went under. The Concordes are no longer flying. Mm-hmm. The ones that are out there, pieces have been auctioned off. They're kind of parted out and made a lot of money for charities and things. Other airplanes, there's one that's still in condition to be flown. They're trying to keep it.
Really?
It's in a museum somewhere.
Oh, okay.
And the rest are just kind of shells, you know, that have been assembled here and there. There's probably, I mean, I'm sure there are others that are in various conditions, states of condition. But, you know, to get a whole list of all 14, that's kind of rough. So,
do you think that this sort of technology would become available in this sort of way again?
I kind of do. I really do. I think people liked this when it was around.
Yeah.
They were always busy. They always had, well, I wouldn't say they always had a full load, but maybe they did. I think towards the end there were maybe some times when, I know they said that they could be profitable even if they were halfway full, but I believe they typically sold out every flight. Even at that price.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. If there was a way to take the price down, if there was sort of a, you know, a Ryanair or a JetBlue of these kind of things, I think the advantages of speed would far outweigh the exotic nature or the initial cost.
Sure, and if you've only got one or two planes operating, it comes down to that exclusivity thing again, where, you know, the rock stars are going to be taking this, the sports stars are going to be taking this, you know, celebrities. I don't know how much more I really have on this, but
yeah,
I tell you, I mean, I know that we just did a quick overview of this thing, and you know, it's worthwhile to look into it and just read kind of the history of this thing because it's really a fascinating plane. There's a lot more to it than what Ben and I are talking about here today. You know, this is the case with a lot of our topics. I fully invite, you know, just please go out and investigate it for yourself and you know, find out some more details about it because it's really a cool thing. And hopefully, I mean, I think that there's room for this in the future. I think you're right.
We hope you got something out of this episode. We love listener mail. You want to do some more?
I would love to.
All right, Scott. Brandon writes in, and he says he was listening to the podcast on the Pike's Peak robot, the robotic Audi. And he wondered what would happen if the Pike's Peak car won the entire race. Who or what would take the prize and the recognition for the win? He also said he likes the podcast, finds us informal and funny.
Ah, very good question.
Yeah.
Who would take the crown, I guess, the trophy? Who gets the credit? The engineers, the technicians who put the thing together? Does Audi as a company take the take the victory? That's strange.
I would imagine that it would be the lab group that was assembled to do it. They would probably get a group picture with the car, and that would be part of their recognition. And this is the one thing that I felt bad because you and I were joking around, and we joked about how I was really old or something, or much older than I am. And so Brandon also asked, is it true that one guy is 50 something? He sounds like he's 20 or even 30. Anyway, Brandon, I'm sorry. That was my poor attempt at humor. I am
60.
I'm 60. I wish that I had the skin of a 50-year-old man, but I've just been in the sun too long. No, we're kidding with you, Brandon. I am between 20 or even 30, and not 50 yet, but hopefully I'll make it there. As always, thanks for listening. If you have any ideas for topics or any particularly good jokes that you've heard or anything about the Concorde, anything at all, please send us an email at highspeedstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com. And be sure to check out the High Speed Stuff blog on the HowStuffWorks.com homepage.